first stop for my bill. I'll move the A2 amendment.
We have that in our packets? Or?
Yeah, I do.
Yes.
Okay. A2. Senator Dahl moves the A2 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, this bill actually was brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Townships, and actually I think the townships were here speaking to us as a group, and it was just made in reference, but I think by Rob Vanosik or someone said, if anybody wants to carry that bill, let us know. And they kind of laughed. As I head out the door, I said, I'd be willing to look at that bill. And so I'm carrying this particular bill. This was introduced to allow local governments to be able to utilize social media to enhance public outreach without violating the open meeting law. Under current law, if a quorum of a governing body were to simultaneously participate in Twitter or a similar electronic forum, an open meeting violation would occur, which essentially means that the first person to post a message gets to control the message, which is not good public policy. As amended, Senate File 527 offers protection to local government officials, but only on forums identified by the governing body, which will allow people to know which sites to monitor. The amendment expressly states the online discussion cannot be the sole means of deliberating an item, and the bill already prohibited the use of social media as a replacement for any required public meeting or hearing, and no vote may be taken online. This bill is truly intended to enhance public involvement in the happenings of their local government. And it's one of those things, as you'll hear other testifiers that may have concerns, it really is, when we think about open meeting laws, and as we think about how we chat or how we share information online, we just want to kind of firm up that we're not trying to violate open meeting law when a couple of people happen to be on Facebook. So those are my opening remarks. I'll let Kent Sulem from the Minnesota Township Association have at it.
Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. As Senator Dahl indicated, this was a bill that actually got started at the very grassroots level through our legislative process. The town board that was trying to promote public awareness and public support for a competitive grant program that was going to be online voting for support of the grant wanted to use social media to reach out to the students at Carleton and St. Olaf. And we had to caution them that they had to be very careful on how they approached that and couldn't have an online discussion for fear of creating a serial meeting and open meeting law violation. But it led them to have the discussion that more and more people are turning to social media as the way they communicate. And if only one member or at least less than the quorum can participate in any online discussion, you really get a skewed message. And so we tried to come up with language. This bill actually started a year ago. It was not introduced in the Senate, but we did have a House file last year. We knew there were concerns at that time. We addressed some of those with the original introduction of the bill this year by making clear you couldn't vote or replace a public meeting with the open forum. No additional comments or suggestions were forthcoming from anybody at that time. At the start of this year, I did flag for the Newspaper Association that we would be bringing this bill back. As soon as I had it back from the reviser, a copy was shared with the Newspaper Association to say, we know you've got some issues. Please let us know what you would like, what would help improve this bill. Again, other than we're not comfortable with it being the response, we're unable to get language. At the time of the first hearing in the other body, it was clarified that there was concerns about it being used for sole deliberations and things like that. And that's what led to the amendment before you that makes it very clear you have to identify the sites so that everybody knows where to look, that they're not having to randomly hunt for websites and wondering where you might be conversing. It has to be identified in the same manner we identify our meeting schedules and newspapers under the open meeting law now so the public knows where to look. It has to be very clear that it's not the only means of deliberation, that it's there for to enhance the public dialogue for those who can't make it to a meeting, those who don't like to attend public meetings, but they still get to have input and know what's happening. And you need to come back to that public hearing, the public meeting, and have your discussion and make any decisions that occur. So we believe we've identified, based on the comments made, put in some safeguards. I know we do not have consensus by any means at this point. Concerns have still been raised, I am very open as this bill moves. I know that the next stop would be the general register, but we are a long ways between now and May 20th, and so I'm more than open to talk to any, whether it's the newspapers or other individuals, with issues of how to make this bill stronger and clearer, to work with them before any floor vote were to occur. But we believe we've addressed a number of the issues and made this a very tight, concrete position that is not going to blow a hole open. I think that's what you'll hear later, that's going to widely destroy the open meeting law. Well, it can't, because it has to be a public forum. It can't be private chat rooms. It can't be invite sites. It has to be a public forum that has been identified as this is where our public body may have some input with members of the public. And so it's modeled largely after work that was done out in the city of Seattle and a couple of other communities to make it clear that it's enhancing public involvement. And so, like I said, I know that there are still some issues out there. We're more than open to working on it before a floor vote would occur. But we've talked to most of you on the committee, both, as Senator Dahl indicated, at our meet and greet early in session and as we shop the bill around. And I would just be happy to stand for questions and ask for your support. Oh, I should also mention, Madam Chair, that this bill has the full support of the League of Cities. We've worked and shopped it among the other local government groups, too, and they have no opposition. And at the first hearing in the other body, I was handed a card from the Three Rivers Park District. I'm not going to say the district supports it, but at least individual commissioners indicated that they strongly support it.
Are there any questions for Senator Dahl or Mr. Sulum? The content of the bill. All right. Senator Peterson.
thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, how do you necessarily quantify a quorum in this environment?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I think it would be as it applies to if it were township officers and there's so many board members on the township board, we know what a quorum is for that. Same way with the county commissioners, et cetera, school board members. There's a set quorum for members that are actually on the boards.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I know that a quorum, that they know what a quorum is or have a definition of a quorum, but I'm just trying to work through this thing in my head right now. How do they establish if there's actually a quorum at a given time in a social media environment?
Mr. Sulum.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, the way it would occur is, first of all, you know, most of the time they would be identifying themselves in the course of the discussion that, you know, as Supervisor A, Supervisor B, so you're going to see it there. The other way that it occurs is at the public meeting. You know, they'll discuss, well, as we were referencing in our online discussion. So there are many different ways, both online and at the public meetings, that would occur before any vote could happen, where you would know if a quorum had been participating. And we do extensive training to our folks, as does the League of Cities, as does the school boards and the counties, as to, you know, this. Do not abuse this. This is not, because then we'll lose any protections we try to obtain. You know, that this is meant to enhance public involvement. And so, you know, there's extensive training that goes on as to being open and honest with it.
Madam Chair, and
Senator Dahl.
I think Mr. Sulum made a really good point. I mean, these are our elected township officers, county commissioners. I mean, they could be violating open meeting laws, you know, in Bill's backyard if they really wanted to. But this is elected officials that we trust in terms of open meeting law. And we basically are taking open meeting law and extending it to the 21st century in terms of how we communicate and allowing for public input.
Madam Chair, if I may make one additional comment.
Just
We actually see this as a way that creates better public scrutiny, because as we all know, once you put something out in cyberspace, it's there. Everybody's going to learn about it very quickly. And so if you're trying to play games, you're going to be called on it very quickly by the very people who put you in office. And so in many ways, there's a self-policing factor, because it instead of having an illegal conversation in the backyard, you're having an open dialogue in a public forum, allowing the public to see and the public to weigh in.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl. I'm not really necessarily opposed. It's just I'm sensitive to open meeting and transparency in government, so I'm just trying to give everyone an opportunity to ask another question if they want, maybe. I don't know. Is there a particular instance or how did this arrive? Is this just kind of a function of, hey, this is where communications technology is at and this is how some people communicate, so we think it's a good idea? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, again, for our members, it first arose out of a township that had a strong desire. And frankly, I'm actually very excited to be able to carry this bill because for those of you who have been around for a while and know townships, or Representative Anderson, who's had a very strong relationship with townships most of his life, townships are not known as being the cutting edge of technology. Our members don't tend to be the leading users of technology. And so to me, it was exciting that they were willing to bring this to the forefront. Because, again, they were trying to do some outreach with the students down on the campuses of St. Olaf and Carleton in particular in this scenario. But it led to the broader discussion of this occurs. And if we're out there and we realize, for example, that a citizen posts a comment about what's occurred at the town board or the school board meeting, whatever the setting may be, and the first person responds. Now, if you want to give the other point of view and such, that would be, under the current law, a likely serial meeting violation of the open meeting law, because you'd have more than potentially the quorum having this online discussion about the official business. Now you're allowing one person to control the message. You're shutting the public out from having an outreach venue. And so this bill just does move us into the modern era and allow better public scrutiny and public input.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, what about web conferencing, video web conferencing, in conjunction with, say, a open chat room or chat board?
Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, again, we just actually had an opinion handed down this past, about a week ago, I believe, upholding under current open meeting law provisions that if you have interactive website and do the notice, you can conduct a current meeting via interactive video, and Skype and similar websites were held to be a valid use. But that is a more formal structure for an actual conducting of the meeting where you could actually have a vote. This is meant to be the general discussion and soliciting of input. It specifically prohibits the final deliberation and voting process. That still has to be done at a traditional meeting. Part of that meeting under current law could occur by Skype or similar technology.
So, Mr. Sulem, that would be subject, the web-based or Skype-based meeting would be subject to open meeting law.
Correct, and it is under current law.
A notice has to be given.
Correct.
Right, et cetera. Okay. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand this as there are groups out there that there may be only three, and so if you've got somebody tweeting something and another member of that group would tweet back, that's a quorum because two could be a quorum at times, and they would then be violating that. It would stop a lot of discussion on that. So I can see where this would be pretty good to change some of that.
Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, can you give me an example of what exactly would be identified as a forum, or what, you know, it says that the social media forums have been first identified by the public body at a public meeting. What, can you give me an example of how you would do that? Would you say we use Twitter, or, I mean, how would you refine that so that it's not somebody having to search a lot in Twitter, for example?
Mr. Sulem?
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund, let me first begin by saying that the definition of social media forum as found in the bill was compiled after a great deal of research on a number of social policy adopted by other states and communities, and then vetted, and I, with all due respect to the fine legal staff here, just because this bill started in the other chamber a year ago, vetted through the state's IT department to say, does this meet correct terminology? And the report back at that time was yes from the state IT department. This was the proper terminology to use for the definition. It would be a Twitter where it's the open public portion of it. For Facebook, again, it's very clear in the bill, it has to be the open public forum. It can't be a private chat room or by invite only. And I admit, I am not a big user of social media at the current time, but I have talked to those who do use it quite a bit, and they assure me that there is definitely the public forum portions and the private invite only, and this applies only, the protection only applies to that which is open.
Madam Chair, I guess what I'm getting at is that some of these, it would be, to me, it seems more straightforward if you say for Facebook, you could define a page or, you know, or somehow you can define a group. Whereas Twitter, I guess I'm just wondering how the public would generally be able to find.
I mean, how you would advertise the opportunity.
So that, you're saying that
have
there's
it on
a list.
The county or the township webpage, or he said announce it at public meetings that we're going to have a discussion. However you announce your public meetings, would you then announce that we're going to have a discussion on Facebook?
Madam Chair, that's the way I would read that, just as you would advertise any of your public forums or meetings related to business.
The same method. Okay, Senator Torres Ray.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Do you want to hear from the other testifiers right now?
Yeah. I think we're just trying to become familiar with what the bill does. So, Senator Peterson, and then we'll go to testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, and this is a little bit outside of the scope of the bill, but I think it's relevant. Do you know what the penetration rate is for social media, either Facebook or Twitter, in the marketplace? You know how many people actually use or have a social media account?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, you probably know as well as I do, based on maybe your own experiences as local candidates running for office, you know, it can be, I think, depending on townships, use in this particular arena, probably not that great, but you know, it's name your level of government, it probably increases by, you know, exponentially.
And by age, too.
True.
Younger people. Okay, let's move on to the testimony. Mark Anfinson. Mr. Anfinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman, members. Good evening, Mark Anfinson. I can keep this brief because Mr. Sulem has provided half of my presumed testimony already for us, so a little bit inaccurately. Okay, first of all, and importantly, we do not oppose the concept that this bill seeks to achieve. Senator Dahl is on to something important, which is making sure our legal framework stays relatively current as technology evolves. The problem we have at the Newspaper Association, the news media have, is that this current version of the bill, the language as you see before you, even with the amendment, is too broad. And frankly, with the vague standards that are set out, would knock a huge hole in the open meeting law, the current open meeting law. I will say this. The issue here, it's got to be understood just how complex this is. Not only does this law apply to every elected government official in the state who participates in public meetings, but it involves a type of technology that is rapidly evolving. There are many social media fora now, and there will be many more, presumably, in the near future. And so to try and digest the impact of using that kind of technology on a statewide basis at every level of government is just very difficult to do. And it's the position we've taken with Mr. Sulem is that let's get this right, let's take our time, let's digest this a bit and get together with a common solution. And I think there is one. But the bill here is a little premature. I'll give you a couple quick examples. On line 14 of the amendment, it says that you're okay, you're not violating the open meeting law if participation is limited to discussion only and no vote is taken. Well, that misapprehends what the courts for 30 years have universally recognized as the central purpose of our open meeting law, which is not for the public to show up at a meeting and watch a ceremonial vote on an issue, but to be able to watch the give and take among the elected officials as they develop the position and as they conclude what they should do. That's the essence of the open meeting law, not ceremonial public votes, which this could lead to. Line 16, the use of social media is not the sole means of deliberation by the public body. Well, what does sole means? What does the sole means of deliberation refer to? Is it 95%, 75%, 50% of the deliberation can be by social media, but some portion has to be in the public meeting? It's very ambiguous. And then there's the issue of the complexity of these forums. How many different social media fora would the citizens have to track down, participate in, log on to, or link into? Why would we want to impose that sort of complexity on our citizens trying to observe their public body at work? On the other hand, it's possible maybe you designate one site where this could occur, and that might function quite well. The important final point I'd make is there's no urgency here. I answer more questions about the state open meeting law than anybody else in the state. I've done this for a long time. There's no surge of complaints or questions from citizens or journalists about social media being used to violate the open meeting law. It's a misapprehension that a serial meeting, as the Supreme Court has defined it, which is a violation, would occur simply because a government official participates in a social media forum now. That's not true. There's a line of court cases which basically say that if, let's say, the entire school board shows up at a public meeting in St. Cloud and is the quorum of the board is present, but they're simply in the audience as other citizens, and they stand up and ask questions or make comments, that is not subject to the open meeting law. That does not trigger the open meeting law. And I think the same thing would be true of this kind of participation in Facebook or Twitter. If they're just participating as other citizens are, there would be no violation, even under current law. Final point. Our interest in the news media is that the open meeting law has historically provided the very best option for observing how public business gets done and why. And that's an important interest, but it's a bit of a selfish interest. I, to be a bit presumptuous, think this is bad for public officials, because right now we have this wonderful system where the public has, even if they don't go to a meeting, they have some level of confidence that their elected officials are going to decide public business at a specified place in a known time on a regular basis. And to create this mystery and confusion, which the current language could do, I don't think that serves the ultimate purposes of democracy. So thank you, Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl has been very receptive to our concerns. My interest here tonight is not to kill this bill. We want to continue to work with Mr. Sulem and Senator Dahl and others to improve it, and I think we can, Madam Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Amphinson? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name again.
Mark Amphinson.
Mr. Amphinson.
Yes.
It's on the agenda.
Oh, okay. I got a whole mess here. but I think Senator Dahl, on the other hand, makes a good point about the fact that social media does increase access to a certain population as well. And so your points are well taken, and I think a lot of them are legitimate. So in the spirit of you not wanting to kill the bill, what you didn't provide was maybe more specific suggestions as to what is the happy medium in terms of the language, and we may not be able to flesh that out here, but I think there is a lot of merit to what Senator Dahl is proposing, and I think there's a lot of legitimacy to what you said. So what are your more concrete suggestions?
Well, Mr. Amphinson. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, an entirely legitimate and appropriate question. I will agree we will not sort that out tonight because I think, as I said, because this law has such broad and diverse application across the state and because social media is so complex in its application, it's going to take some time to develop confidence we have got the right balance. But I do think, for example, and this goes back to a point Senator Wicklund made in her remarks a minute ago, I think, for example, just to talk about where you'd have a single social media site, maybe one or at the most two, that the elected officials would designate and that the exchanges that they might engage in would occur there And citizens could easily log on to that site. I mean, the goal of broader public engagement and public discussion is an absolutely laudable one. And again, this approach will, I think, be negative. But there's one not too far away from it, such as I described, that may be very positive.
More witnesses, testifiers.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. Chuck Nagel. Chuck, are you here? Mr. Nagel, nice to see you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, ma'am. And Madam Chair and the rest of the committee, I echo much of what I just heard, and primarily I am not against the concept. I believe I had a smartphone 10 years ago, long before they were known as a smartphone. It's an evolution of technology. We absolutely need to get more people involved in the decision-making process. And as a school board member, I am continually frustrated by the lack of interaction with the public. So the concept is wonderful. I also share many of the comments of Mr. Anfinson that I don't want to see it killed. I want to see it worked out. It's too broad. There is no urgency. Or at least I don't perceive it to be. But I would like to read to you just one sentence from the document from the Minnesota Association of Townships, which they give to their township members, that talks about the purpose of the open meeting law: to prohibit actions being taken in a secret meeting where it is impossible for the interested public to become fully informed concerning board decisions and to detect proper influences. And from the League of Minnesota Cities open meeting law exceptions, which this is a exception, the open meeting law is designed to favor public access. Therefore, the very few exceptions that do exist are carefully limited to avoid abuse. That is what I'm promoting, is putting some limits, like you heard a minute ago, spend some time and put some limits so we don't have abuse, potential abuse. I would go so far as to promote that there be a single forum someplace, and I believe the senator mentioned possibly even a township or a city council webpage, but a single place that everybody knows where you go to stay in tune with what the elected officials are discussing. I would go a bit further from what you heard a minute ago. This will be my final comment, is that I would like to see it limited to the public officials only, the elected officials. That way, someone doesn't have to read through hundreds or thousands of postings from citizens who can be using a fictitious name when they subscribe to Facebook or Twitter or something else, to filter down to find out what the elected officials are saying. Limited to the elected officials, and if the public wants to comment, they have my phone number, they have my email address, I'll be happy to answer the phone. But allow it a very easy, non-burdensome way for elected officials to communicate. It's the way of the future. Thank you much for your time.
Madam Chair, maybe if I could make some final comments. Thank you.
We had another witness.
Do we?
Deborah Ewalls.
I have a question.
Thank you. Mr. Nagel, any questions for Mr. Nagel?
No, I'll wait until
okay.
After the next
All right, Ms. Ewalls. Thank you, Mr. Nagel.
Good evening, Madam Chair, Senators.
Just introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Deborah Ewalls. I live in Jordan, Minnesota. I'm just a citizen, although I'm married 25 years to the former mayor of my city. I have some concerns with this bill. I do see some need for some further clarification in the open meeting law regarding the new methods of communication. However, this bill, in my opinion, is not there yet. It needs much more fleshing out. Currently, it's unacceptable for a quorum of an elected body to, if they're at a public function, maybe they're at the park for a festival or something, to discuss city business or official business as a quorum. That is a public place. Anybody can be there. But they can't discuss as a quorum public business. And on their official website. If they're going to have a meeting, there are certain requirements, notice requirements, data practice requirements. And now to go to an electronic meeting, we do have legislation for how to handle a telephone meeting or an electronic meeting with guidelines for how to handle the notice and the data practices. Now, this exception now provides a way for a quorum of a public body to discuss public business at a time unknown, an agenda unknown, and data practices are exempted because it's not called a meeting. However, I believe data practices would apply in the fashion that an elected official is required to keep their own, I think, written communications and those sort of things for data practice purposes. But how would we keep track for data practices of the communications that happen online? And I have some concern that this could become the main means of communication because it's kind of a workaround to get out from under some of the other guidelines. It could be a way to gain a consensus, intentionally or not intentionally. The discussion may lead to a solid viewpoint, and the public will not have had the opportunity to be part of that conversation. So I would really encourage much more discussion before this is finalized or it's not anywhere close at this point, although it is something that's needed.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Ewalls? All right, thank you then very much.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl, comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I've heard of the last two, three testifiers say this is something needed. I look at this we heard about vague standards versus no standards. I actually feel that this is putting parameters in place. I believe that we've, on 1-1-1, social media forums have first been identified. We are telling the public where these are. I also believe in lines 14 and 16 that we it says participation is limited to discussion and no decision or vote. That's a parameter on the web, on the social media. And then 116, it's not the sole means. There are other means. We want to people to know that this is not the only discussion that's going to be taking place. It's not going to take place of our other opportunities for public to weigh in. So in terms of urgency, hey, technology's passed me by many years ago. We need to get ahead of this and not chase it down the road, and I believe that's what the townships are trying to do here. We've had some concerns already raised. I believe this is the good first step. It's not the last step. So I think let's put this in place and then continue to have the discussions with the Newspaper Association and others to make sure that we do have the right language in place.
Senator Dahl, I know there's an amendment coming, and I have some suggestions as well. So this, here's what I'm suggesting. On line 1.11, the social media forums' dates and times have been identified by the public body at a public meeting, and a list of the identified social media forums is, instead of kept on file, publicly posted at the primary offices and on their official webs and on the official website of the public body, which is probably what you're going to do anyway. You know, I mean, you want people to know about the forums. You're going to list the forums, social media forums, on your website and maybe have a sign that says, join the public forums, right? And we're going to have them next week or the week after. So, Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, to those issues, I have absolutely no objection to a posting requirement. I think that is absolutely fine. It's consistent with what we do with other notices as well. The issue that I had raised at this time about inserting language about public forums that the date and time of use be listed is that the whole purpose of social media is you don't know when somebody's going to be right. posting the question. You don't know when you're going to be okay. responding. But that's I would also, in light of the conversation that would be held, and I apologize, I hope I didn't step on proper protocol, but I did ask Ms. Stengel, I would be very amenable to, on 1.13, having language that would say a public body may not identify more than three social media forums as a starting place for the proper cap. The reason I think it needs to be more than one is that you do have Twitter and Facebook now. There's interlinks that happen between those forums. So I think it needs to be more than one. But I do agree that we don't want to have – I wouldn't want my members listing 150. That would not be a proper thing. And so I would propose at this point – I did mention to Mr. Anfinson as a starting point for the dialogue that we'd insert a cap of three at this point. And certainly before this bill had a final vote on the floor, if there was a good rationale for something different – we're very open to that, but I think that would be a very good place to start.
Okay. And then what on the official website? Do you think that's all right?
On the official website, if one exists. Not everybody has a website.
Okay.
And that I believe, Ms. Stengel could correct me if I'm wrong, is traditional language that we've done on other web postings.
Okay. Then also I had a suggestion that in 1.16 you say the use of social media forums is not the sole or primary means of deliberation by the public body. So we're dealing a little bit with Mr. Amphinson's concern about 90%, or we're not being that specific, but still expect that the public meeting in the traditional way is going to be the primary means of deliberation.
Madam Chair, I would have no objection if the author has no objection.
Madam Chair, we'll be happy to have those amendments.
Okay, well, let's take them one at a time if Senator Eaton could help me out so that we can make sure we get them. So on page 1.12, do you want to keep them on file and publicly post, or just, do you think, publicly post?
Madam Chair, we would keep them on file anyhow, so.
I think the public's going to be more interested in the public posting.
The posting is where they're going to look.
Right.
So whichever the comfort of the committee is fine.
Any thoughts?
That's fine. Well.
Keep it? Okay. So just say and publicly post, then keep on file and publicly post. Okay. So Senator Eaton moves on 1.12 after file, insert, and publicly post. We might as well continue it then. And then after offices, insert, and on the official website, if one exists, of the public body. Does that sound correct? Okay. Everybody got the motion? Should I read it again?
I need that on.
1.13, after offices, insert, and on the official website, if one exists. Senator Johnson?
I really apologize, but I wasn't here for the beginning of the presentation, Senator Dahl. And I need to hear from you, first of all, what is the purpose of this? Is it just so that... fewer than a quorum, people get together and talk? Or is it interaction?
Madam
but
Chair.
But nobody knows when you're going to do it, and so you just got to, I mean, you want to use it just for a conversation?
Madam Chair, you're right. We did cover all of that. It is just to not get people in trouble that are having legitimate discussion. So it's, you know, we want to be very upfront. This is not a secret meeting that we're trying to have. There's just, it's an opportunity for the public to engage with social media, with elected officials. We're trying to do outreach. And in that process, we want to make sure that the members of the townships or counties or cities are not violating open meeting laws.
On the Eaton motion, does anyone need to have it restated? All right, then all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then Senator Eaton moves on line 1.16, after Seoul to insert or primary. Any discussion on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Now, there are other amendments.
Chair.
Senator Hall.
I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
A3 amendment. It's coming.
I'm going to, Madam Chair.
Senator Hall, why don't you explain it so we can engross it?
I'll let Ms. Stengel explain it, but let me tell you, if I may, prior to it, the purpose.
Okay.
In listening to the dialogue and Mr. Amphison and some of his thoughts, there are a lot of people that don't necessarily have Twitter or Facebook. There certainly are a lot that do. But most people, whether they have it or not, are website accessible. If not, they can go to the library, get a website. And so this bill would basically say there's only one at this point, and I think this is something that will grow. But I'd like to be a little more cautious in the beginning. This would say there is one interactive site that would be on the main website of the governing body. So if you're a township, you've got a website, you would put a forum on there that everybody could talk about, and that would be listed, of course, as others. It would be posted that that's what you have going, and when something new comes up, people could actually get notified if they wanted to get notified that a new one was coming up. But it would just be one. It would be another way for media to get out there and to have discussion, and that I think would be great for the public to be able to get into, because some people can't always come to the meetings, too. So I think the whole idea is great, but I think this would suffice a little bit more, Mr. Amphison, and some of his thoughts, and I have some of those concerns, too. So, Ms. Stengel, if you would, any more need to share on that?
Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hall. That summarizes it exactly right. I'm going to hit a couple of the technical points. Because we're in the amendment using the phrase interactive forum instead of social media, we would lose the definition of social media in paragraph B. And we would also, because there is only the one forum that will be identified, we will also, the amendment would also take away some of the language that was adopted in the oral amendment a few minutes ago.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
I'd be opposed to the amendment. It pretty much guts the bill that I'm trying to put forward, and considering all the types of social media that we have out there, not a lot of our townships even have a website. So, again, we are we're not trying to over-regulate. We are actually just trying to give some comfort to the members that actually use some of the social media out there to make sure that, indeed, they are not violating the open meeting law. And, again, I go back to who are your elected officials in your townships, in your counties, at your school boards. Are they really trying to bypass the open meeting laws through electronic media? If so, then they should be voted out. But those aren't the kind of people that we're talking about here for this particular issue. So I ask you to vote against the amendment.
I mean, I like the intent of the amendment to kind of simplify the forum, which is why I said I wanted them to have publicly post the forums and the dates and times. But I think the problem is if some of the townships don't have websites, then it does, and they can, but other people have independent,
Madam Chair,
so computers and you know, or smartphones and access other methods. So that's the problem I see. Mr. Sulem.
And Madam Chair, that is the general, Senator Hall, I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish, but I think it's a separate issue. One issue is trying to say we're going to have a new means of electronic meeting, and the other is saying in today's world with the use of Twitter and Facebook that are not ours to control per se, but they are public venues, that right now we couldn't defend ourselves, we couldn't respond to a posting on those types of website, and that's what we're trying to address with the base bill. This would be a separate issue, a separate concept for another area of dialogue. And I'd certainly be willing to have that with you for a separate bill on a separate issue, but it does go in the opposite direction of what we're trying to address. And if I may, just from a legal perspective, Mr. Anfinson was trying to distinguish why he didn't think there'd be a violation under current law. The difference between, using my members as an example, a quorum or the entire town board going to the county meeting or to the school board meeting, when they're there at those meetings, they're there as parents, they're there as residents, and they're not there on behalf of the township doing township business. The purpose of what we're trying to address here is the fact that if somebody posts on a Twitter account, I can't believe what that township's doing on the town road, I can't believe they're going to spend that much money on a repair, the road's just fine, and the first supervisor posts, I agree with you, that's why I voted opposed this project. The second supervisor wants to say, hey, here's the liability concerns. You're not thinking of the whole process. Come to the meeting. They couldn't do that because now they've discussed the town business as a quorum. So it's a different scenario than Mr. Anfinson outlined, where you're attending a meeting for a totally different purpose.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
I withdraw my amendment.
Okay. Any other discussion on the bill? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, Senator, about, there's a good use of social media to kind of expose an issue and kind of educate the community. I think that's a very useful tool because many times we deal with very complex issues that you just don't have the time to explain. So you kind of put it out in social media and people begin to talk about what it is and questions begin to be posted and people learn about what it is. And then that kind of forms an opinion. It forms a public opinion. And people, we as elected officials begin to see kind of what's going on and what people in our districts think about it. And then it kind of directs that opinion influences a decision. So it's not per se, kind of a decision that is being made. But if we don't pay attention to that, I'm afraid that indeed, it's a step of a decision in a way. It's moving in a direction that kind of puts us in a place. So do you perceive that to be a problem where, we're not sure where we're moving in terms of decisions, and you could use as elected official that medium to influence a decision of your peers? So you begin to call, for instance, Senator Wicklund's constituents and say, you post that, and then she knows that these are individuals that live in the area, and she begins to see that a lot of her constituents are participating in this public forum to influence her decision. So I'm concerned about that issue and not, so somehow we have to put some kind of boundary to that. So that's kind of my main concern, because I do think that social media, it's very good for that, because you can call, 100 people in your district, and then you get all of these postings, and all of a sudden you change the decision just on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres Rea, that probably already happens. So, without regard to the quorum aspect that we're talking about here, that is happening already. So what we're doing, again, I think Mr. Sulem can correct me, is, again, we are actually putting out front, hey, given the fact that we have Twitter and Facebook and everything else, here are some more clarification on what the open meeting laws in terms of your participation. And we've been very clear here about what you should do. And so, don't read into this more than what there is. We're just trying to give some, I think, clarification. Would that be honest?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I believe Senator Dahl summarized it very well, what this is allowing. If somebody wants to be a bad actor, they're going to find a loophole in any law that's out there. If right now you were to call somebody and say, send 500 emails to this individual member and tell them to vote no, that can already occur. The difference being is that's done in private. If you're doing that on a public forum, people are going to know what you're doing. It's actually going to put more sunshine on the issue. And the broad advantage is that we are trying to get more public input. I mean, I think most of you that have local government experience, whether it be a county meeting, a school board meeting, or a town meeting, the attendance doesn't tend to be very large. You're actually going to get more public input, have a better understanding what the general public wants if you allow a little bit of social media use, but with these careful confines that we've put on here. So, you know, if there's a bad actor out there, no matter what safeguards we put on, they're going to find a loophole around it. There's been litigation to those effects. They usually get punished. We certainly, this provides us very clear guidelines of how to train and say, don't be the bad actor, don't do that. And ultimately, if you're the one doing it, the electors are going to find out, and they're going to find out easier if you've got the public forum going.
Sure. Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Yes. You're right, the bad actors will do this, but does this say that, say, we put a put on Facebook, you want to have a discussion with some of the other members of the group, and this is this what you're talking about, only doing it public? Because on Facebook, I could do a group that would be private, a private message to a group and have a discussion back and forth. Can they do that to this?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, line 1.10, the social media forum are open to public participation. It must be the open public part. It cannot be an invite. It cannot be a close. It must be the open.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll move 527 as amended.
Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Any more discussion? Any more testimony? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Dahl. Senator Schmidt, we've had to we had to rearrange your bills. Senator Schmidt here. I guess your Natural Resources Department bill added task force or something or a commission, and it doesn't meet our guidelines. So Ms. James is preparing an amendment.
Oh, okay. All
so right. We're going to take the silica sand bill 1018 first.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. If I could, I'll just go ahead and offer the A2 amendment. It's a technical amendment to Senate File 1018, if I could offer that now.
I move that.
Yeah. Senator Torres Ray moves the A2 amendment. Do you want to just tell us briefly what it does, since this isn't your first committee?
Sure. It is. It's pretty straightforward, as I mentioned. I think you're running through here on page 3, line 17. It clarifies that the...
does everyone have it first? Let's just wait a second and make sure everyone has it.
Okay.
The amendment's passed out? All right, Senator Schmidt.
Okay, on essentially this is the subdivision 3 here, beginning on 3.13, and this technical amendment clarifies that the technical assistance team that we're proposing we create must not impose any fee or charge for their services upon local units of government. We're clarifying that here in statute or in the language. And then we're also clarifying that the team is appointed rather than chosen. So that's on line 3.18. Chosen is stricken and replaced with appointed. We're also deleting line 3.35 with an effective date, and we're replacing an effective date at the end of section 5. And I think the last change here is on page 4, line 4, and we are striking the word A and replacing with an online library, just to clarify what kind of library we're speaking to here. And I'll clarify all of this and put it in proper context when I run through the bill here.
All right. Senator Torres Ray moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Schmidt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We were here just a couple weeks ago talking about the issue of silica sand, and very pleased to see some activity in the House in the last week. This is a bill that was introduced and moved through two House committees last week and gained great support. I know we're going to have some lively discussion tonight. But what we have here essentially is we do have in Section 1 some definitions. Of course, that's common. We see that around here a lot. We also have in Subdivision 2 on line 2.9, We have the creation of standards and criteria from the Environmental Quality Board, and what we're stressing is that the EQB works in consultation with local units of government to develop model standards and criteria for mining, processing, and transporting silica sand. And we proceed here on the rest of page 2 and about the top third of page 3 in spelling out what exactly we want these model ordinances and criteria to address. And then moving on to subdivision 3 here, line 3.13, we're asking the silica sand technical assistance team to assemble we're asking EQB to assemble a silica sand technical assistance team to provide local units of government, again, upon their request, with assistance in creating ordinances and permitting decisions and such. And moving on, we have in subdivision 4, local units of government can consider adopting the recommendations of the technical advisory team. If they choose not to, they simply have to specify why they're not choosing to adopt those recommendations. And then finally, on section 2, we're asking this technical assistance team to create through the Environmental Quality Board an online library of essentially government ordinances relating to silica sand mining. So we have some rules. We're asking a PCA to adopt rules pertaining to the control of particulate emissions from silica sand mines. This is in Section 3. We're asking the Commissioner of Natural Resources to adopt rules pertaining to the reclamation of silica sand mines. And we're also asking the Department of Health to adopt air quality health advisories for silica sand. Of course, we have appropriation here as well, and this is essentially the bill, pretty straightforward. And I guess with that said, I'd be happy to take any questions if folks have them. There may be some testimony here tonight, too.
Okay, are there any questions as to the content of the proposal right now? All right, why don't we move into testimony then. On the list I have Mr. Fred Corrigan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fred Corrigan. I'm Executive Director of the Aggregate Ready Mix Association. I'm sorry we haven't seen the amendment at this point, but I would like to commend Senator Schmidt on working with us on through this process and recognizing some of the impacts that this has on the traditional aggregate industry. He has stricken some language that was probably not directed at the intent of the bill, which was the silica sand industry as it is created. I do want to go back, Madam Chair and committee members, just to talk a little bit about the process that the legislature has gone over in the last decade with the legislative task force in 1999 and 2000, and again in 2008 with an aggregate tax increase and just change in the distribution to local government. There was a strong commitment made at that time to the legislature, or to the process that local government continues to be encouraged to do comprehensive planning, to do appropriate zoning, to carefully use conditional use permits, and more today, interim use permits, which allows the permit to stay open for any additional technology or changes that the local government wants to use, and reaffirmed the purpose of the local option aggregate tax for the county to impose or not impose. Today, 31 counties impose that tax. The rest do not impose that tax on traditional aggregate. So a strong commitment made by the legislature to the local governments approving these operations, including silica sand. Silica sand is not new in this state, as you're learning, and this industry has been carefully regulated by the legislature, by local government, and by state agencies in permitting. The EQB is not currently involved in that process in any way. The MPCA is involved, the Minnesota Department of Health, the DNR, and other agencies that have been very involved and do have a permitting process within their agencies. The EQB has, I believe, staff of 2 people, so I'm not sure what the EQB's capacity to carry out very much of this is. And so we're concerned
About the ability of the UQB to actually deliver some of the things that are proposed. Currently, the EAW process takes a year or two because of this process. An EIS process takes 2 to 4 years to permit these properties and can cost as much as $1 million a year in that process. State permits, as I mentioned, are available. So our members do support and have worked with Senator Schmidt on the technical advisory committee process. Other states have used this. And we do support formally establishing those committees, although we feel like those committees informally exist today. The agencies, through the comment period, work very closely together, work throughout the comments that each agency is making, and that input is very much present in the process today. So, Madam Chair, we're kind of wondering a little bit about a process that the legislature's spent many years involved in, has worked with local governments to preserve these resources, and now as we try to continue to mine properties that have been mined in some cases for decades, we find a whole new regulatory process being proposed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Corrigan? Then next we have Eric Bryan. Welcome to the committee. Would you repeat your name for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Bryan. I'm just pulling out my draft here. My name is Eric Bryan. I am the Director of Marketing for Bryan Rock Products. Bryan Rock Products is a 72-year-old family-run limestone mining company. My brother Matt and I represent the fourth generation of Bryans involved with running the business. We have three locations in the Twin Cities metro area. They include Shakopee, which is in Scott County, and also Bayport and Hastings, which are located in the Hastings in Washington County. Excuse me. The construction aggregate market has taken a substantial hit due to the recession. Exploration at our existing Shakopee quarry revealed a substantial deposit of high-quality silica and beneath the limestone we had been mining for years. Bryan Rock decided to pursue a mining and processing plant together with an adjacent property owner and formed Merriam Junction Sands. In 2010, we began the permitting process and initiated an environmental impact statement to study our proposed project. 3 years later, at a cost of $1.5 million to date and an estimated cost in excess of $2 million when completed, we are still in the environmental review stage of our project permitting. While undergoing the environmental review process, we are not allowed to proceed in any way on the project, and none of the other required state permits, air emissions, stormwater, water appropriations, or local permits, interim use, or building permits can be used. All of this time and money is invested at risk without any guarantee of approvals by the government. While preparing the EIS, we have met on multiple occasions with county staff, township officials to review different sections of this draft EIS. State and federal agencies have been invited onto discussions by the county to utilize their expertise and input in developing the draft EIS. These agencies have included the DNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, MPCA, and MnDOT. In conclusion, we believe that our local government is a great example of a county that is well-equipped to review and permit projects such as ours. Our experience has been that help from state agencies is currently available for local governments or local communities. Current regulations are sufficient and effective, and there is no need to add additional layers of government, review, or regulation, or impose additional taxes that may impact our ability to do competitive in the marketplace and compromise our ability to provide high-quality jobs and contribute to the economic growth of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your comments. Any questions for Mr. Bryan? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott.
Thanks for all the work.
Sustacek. There's no H in there. Sustacek. Welcome to the committee. Please repeat your name for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Sustacek. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Jordan Sands. We're an emerging sand business located in Mankato, Minnesota. We're part of Coughlin Companies, and the Coughlin family has been mining limestone in the Mankato area for 125 years. And basically, it's a family-owned businesses of serial entrepreneurs who also have a substantial children's book publishing business. They employ about 240 people here in Minnesota and about 350 people worldwide. If Bob Kaufman were here, which he has been on past occasions, he would remind me that his grandfather also supplied all the limestone in the Capitol. And so it's an interesting organization. As part of the Mankato Casota Stone business, we've been through several environmental reviews for the limestone business. We've worked closely with Lime Township, with the City of Mankato, with Blue Earth County, the DNR, and the MPCA through these processes. Our silica sand project really began in 2011 with what we term a brownfield development in existing mines and quarries near Mankato. We have spent the time launching the project and preparing our environmental assessment worksheet and developing all the corresponding studies and data that go along with it to build a very credible project. At present, we're in the middle of that environmental review process, and we have spent in excess of $1 million on what will ultimately be a 70-acre mine. It'll be a completely integrated mining operation with minimal trucking, and will also be placed in existing quarries in an area where there's an active landfill, in an industrial zone, where we also have an incinerator and several other mining operations. Greater Mankato Growth has taken a look at our project for us and estimated that when it reaches its ultimate capacity, it will generate over $100 million in economic activity for the Mankato area. We intend to have ultimately 70 new jobs created with this, and these will be good-paying, put-your-kids-through-college kind of jobs. And I know there tends to be a lot of excitement and enthusiasm around a Walmart coming to town. These are certainly much better jobs than retail. We feel that, from our perspective, it's essential that local RGUs continue to have the flexibility to address these issues that come along with mining operations in the way that they deem the best possible route to take. There are numerous RGUs who are comfortable working with proposers on projects and through projects of this type. There are those that are not. And for those that are not, we believe in the technical panel concept within this bill. We think this is a good vehicle for those RGUs who are challenged with how they go forward with a project like this. The appropriate state agencies that were mentioned earlier by Mr. Bryan are MPCA, the DNR, already deeply involved in projects of this type. And we would like that strong state control to continue as needed by the local RGUs.
Could you, Mr.
Sustachek.
Sustachek, what are RDUs?
RGU.
RGUs again?
Responsible Government Unit.
Oh, yeah,
sorry.
Okay. We should all know that.
I apologize. And I think what ultimately happens out of this is you, with the strong state involvement, with RGUs that understand the process, you get good projects coming out of it. And case in point, Uniman, which is in Casota, near Mankato, just permitted 1,000 acres. And I believe Le Sueur County would say that they have that project under control and they know how to handle mining operations of that type. Great Plains Sands in Scott County, another good story. There's been a lot of talk about Minnesota Sands or Minnesota Proppants. And again, you had state agencies like the MPCA, the Department of Health, stepping in and telling the proposer this is not a good project. And ultimately, out of that, you get proposers either dropping projects or correcting projects and making them better. But state involvement in all these processes the way it is today ultimately gives these projects a much stronger footing, much better input. I think to pay, obviously, who's going to pay for this technical assistance? I think we feel that mechanism is already in place with the proposer pay. From our own perspective, as we go through our environmental process, we're paying for a consultant for Lime Township, as well as a firm that's working for them, as well as an attorney for the township. I believe Uniman did the same thing. I believe Great Plains did the same thing. We think that model self-funds, and not only does it self-fund, but it also serves as a way to vet projects coming forward to make certain that proposers are serious, that they've thought through the project, that it's a credible project. Minnesota has been, and I think Senator Schmidt and I agree on this, we've been blessed with great sand. I've heard him say it before. And this is really Minnesota's opportunity to participate in the energy revolution going on around this country that's created, by estimates, 1.7 million jobs in a very difficult environment nationwide. We really cannot make the solution so expensive that it puts operators in this industry, especially small ones like ours, trying to come into the marketplace. At risk by imposing high taxes or fees that really make us non-competitive with people around the country. In closing, I would like to thank Senator Schmidt for his openness and willingness to work through this issue and ultimately get to a strong, stable economic opportunity that builds our tax base through economic growth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the witness? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you heard of Save the Coosota Prairie back in the 80s?
Madam Chair, Senator, I had, yes.
Okay, I'm one of the founders.
Are you?
And I want you to know that Uniman did not know how to do it, and Seward County did not know how to do it back in the 80s.
Right.
We had a very large group of activists and environmentalists who walked through the process with them, let's put it that way. And we did come to a reasonable solution. So I'm hoping that same kind of process happens in the rest of the Lyme Township. And
Madam Chair?
Sister Check.
Senator? One of the things that we've tried to do from the start is engage the township in a discussion, especially as it moves toward reclamation of what does the township want. And within the city of Mankato, we've got a quarry there as well, and we've worked with the city to ultimately, that'll be reclaimed and given to the city as a very large holding pond for reuse water, which is water that's non-potable, but water that can be used for irrigation purposes that the city generates. So we're looking for ways that we can work with those city officials, township officials, to develop things like you did in the Coosota Prairie, which to your credit in Uniman's is outstanding.
Senator Anderson. Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Thank you very much. Any other questions? And we love your stone. Beautiful stone. Kirsten Powley. And I guess I'm going to have to ask the witnesses to speed up a little bit. It's getting late. We have three bills left after this one.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I will try to keep my comments brief. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kirsten Pauly. I'm a registered civil engineer and a registered geologist with Sunday Engineering, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Industrial Sand Council. I have been directly involved in local permitting of some of the existing industrial sand mining and or processing facilities that are currently operating in Minnesota. And my experience has been that local government has proven to be capable, thorough, and effective in the evaluation and permitting of industrial sand mining and processing facilities. In my opinion, two counties that I've worked extensively and have issued conditional use permits or interim use permits for industrial sand mining facilities in the past year, and these include Le Sueur County and Scott County, are great examples of the ability of local government to very capably and very effectively regulate the industry. I believe that there are five characteristics that contributed to the success of the permitting process that these two local governments developed. One was comprehensive environmental review, and you've heard testimony tonight on some of that process and the length of time that it takes and the resources that it takes. The environmental review really helps identify issues that need to be considered in the permitting process. Another key point is strong local land use ordinances that develop standards to protect the environment, land use adjacent to the proposed mine sites, as well as protect residents in the area while allowing the utilization of the natural resources. A third point is local government in these two instances reached out to state agencies and outside experts for input and guidance on technical issues such as air and groundwater that may have been outside the realm of the county's expertise. And in my experience, these agencies and outside experts were more than willing to come together with the counties and the applicant and sit down and discuss the issues that were at hand. Another important key in the success of these permits was the development of a number of monitoring plans that were used to measure the effectiveness of some of the conditions that were placed on the projects. And these monitoring plans were developed using information that was obtained through the environmental review process and made and incorporated into the conditional use or interim use permits. And the last key was the ability for these counties to open up the permits if, in fact, there was additional information that was obtained through future studies or if there were changes to regulations that would warrant opening up these permits and revisiting the conditions of those permits. The local permitting process for these industrial sand mining and processing projects have taken 2 to 4 years to evaluate by the local units of government, and they've resulted in permits that have set forth a variety of conditions that cover a number of areas, including setbacks, hours of operations, surface water quality and monitoring, groundwater quantity and quality and monitoring, fuel storage, noise, screening, blasting, air quality, public infrastructure, lighting, inspections, annual reporting. They cover a whole variety of areas where conditions can be imposed, including reclamation standards and bonding for reclamation. Local governments have readily available examples of some comprehensive mining ordinances and strong local permits. The projects that have been recently permitted in Scott County and Le Sueur County are excellent examples of strong local control working with strong state-level permitting requirements. The approved projects demonstrate that local government is doing a good job, that there are state standards in place, and that the state agencies are currently available and willing to provide technical assistance to those governments who feel that they need or want additional guidance or input. I would like to thank Senator Schmidt for his continued willingness to work with the industry, his constituents, and fellow legislators as this discussion continues to evolve in a meaningful way, and I'd like to thank you, Senator, and committee members.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Pauley? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Pauley. You forgot to mention the one thing that you have in place that the other counties might not, and that might be mining. And you've had the luxury of 70 years of mining, and you've been able to build a pretty good system in place, and I just worry about those counties that don't have the resources. But you mentioned all the resources available, but my understanding of what Senator Schmidt's trying to do is to make sure that we have a cohesive plan for all of those other counties that don't have existing mining and that need good model ordinances. I see this as more of a help in trying to make sure that we're consistent. And if every county was like Le Sueur and Scott, we probably wouldn't have to worry about this. But I worry about those counties that have never had this experience, and all of a sudden they're ripe for mining. And I just want to make sure that we have something in place. So the fact that you forgot to mention that you have mining, I think, is probably your biggest omission.
Ms. Pauley?
Thank you for pointing that out. And, yes, these are communities that have had mining in the past. They're not the only two counties in the state that have had mining in the past. The Minnesota Industrial Sand Council does support some type of a technical panel for evaluation and does support providing help from these various state agencies to local governments that need it. My testimony is simply to point out that my experience personally has been that the state agencies currently are very willing to provide assistance when asked.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple of questions because I don't actually know the information. Definitely. How many people are employed in the silica sand mining industry in Minnesota, and what is the median wage for people that work in the industry?
Ms. Pauley?
Senator, I am not sure on the total number of people employed in the industrial sand mining operation at this point in time. I have heard previous testimony. I'm not an expert on what the actual wages are, but my understanding is that they're around the $60,000 per year figure or more.
Do you have a lobbyist in the room that knows that?
Yeah, I'm sure that there are people in the room that know that.
You're here on. Okay.
Do we want someone to come forward, or should we? Are we moving on?
We can move on.
All right, Senator Anderson.
I thought maybe okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Pauley. You mentioned Le Sueur and Scott County being having their process and procedures in tip-top shape. If other counties who are doing mining, if they have not met the guidelines set by the state of Minnesota, then is it the state of Minnesota that's at fault for not going after them and saying that they're doing the mining procedures wrong?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Pauley.
Senator, if I understand your question correctly, I believe that if the state standards are not being met, for example, the state standards that have been established by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, for example, air emissions, and are regulated under the air emissions permit, the state would be responsible for enforcing those permit conditions. If it is a local condition of the interim use permit or the conditional use permit, such as hours of operation that may be violated, or a standard that's contained within that local permit, then the local government would be responsible for enforcing those standards.
Well, Madam Chair.
Mary Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pauley, it sounds like there's two counties that are doing it right. I mean, you're saying giving accolades for these two counties, but then the rest of the counties that are supposedly have mining or been given the permission to allow mining to happen in their counties, it seems like those people from the state who are supposed to be overseeing these counties have looked the other way and not meeting the standards that have been set for Le Sueur and Scott County. It seems like there's neglect in the state system for properly overseeing the way these mining operations are done in whatever other counties it might be.
Ms. Pauley?
Madam Chair, Senator, my experience has been, and I simply have been speaking about Le Sueur County and Scott County because those are the two that have actually recently made it through the lengthy permit process and have actual permits in hand. I do believe that there are other communities that have also been working on the permits, and my experience is that the government, the state agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, have been engaged in the air emissions permitting of these other facilities, as well as the water appropriations permitting, that there is a great deal of involvement, and I have not seen, personally, I have not seen any neglect.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator Anderson. We have one more witness, Daryl
Madam
Batiste. Senator Torres-Ray.
Madam Chair, I'm just aware that you have three more bills that we have to hear. I just would like to know, I think that the provisions that we're looking at are subdivision 3 and 4, and I just would like to make sure that we continue to, and section 3, because we're talking about permits and we're talking about other issues and also testimonies that go beyond, I think, what we're supposed to review in this committee.
I appreciate that reminder.
Thank you.
For all of us. Is it Pettis?
Pettis, that's
Pettis.
Correct.
Mr. Pettis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Daryl Pettis. I currently serve as the Le Sueur County Administrator and the Le Sueur County Highway Engineer. Sewer County, we've had a long history with silica sand mining. Our first permit for silica sand mining was actually pulled in 1973, and we have records that go back into the 30s when sand mining first started within the Sewer County. We currently have three plants that are in operation and producing silica sand within the county. Two are in the Cassota Township and one is in Ottawa Township. During the past 5 years, the Le Sueur County Board has approved two conditional use permits for sand mine expansion. In 2010, we approved a 1,015-acre expansion in Ottawa Township, and then in 2013, we approved a 1,334-acre expansion in Kasota Township. Both of these projects required environmental impact statements and took approximately 4 years to complete the environmental work and the permitting process. A third mine expansion has also been proposed for 486 acres, but that expansion is currently on hold. It is our opinion that local control of land use is the best and serves our citizens the best. What type of impact does this have on our county? In 2011, our sand producer, Uniman Corporation, paid $476,000 in property tax. In addition, in 2012, they contributed $515,000 to Le Sueur County in the form of aggregate tax, of the $679,000 we did collect in aggregate tax. In addition to this, the Uniman Corporation has funded in excess of $3 million in transportation projects to Le Sueur County. What is the impact that I see on Senate File 1018 to Le Sueur County? We have really no issue with Subdivision 2. We do not oppose the standards and criteria. They are very similar to what we currently have in our zoning ordinance, but as Ms. Pauley referenced, we do have a number of other items that do not show up there within our current zoning ordinance dealing with permitting. It took us about 4 years to update our zoning ordinance, and it is quite a long process. Issue we do have is in Section 3 under Subdivision Rules B. Le Sueur County, we do not support the DNR's rules pertaining to reclamation of sand mines. We feel this is a local land use issue and control, and it is best handled by the locals. Currently, our zoning ordinance does require DNR shall review any and all of our reclamation plans, but they do not. We do not ask them to make rules. So, with that, I thank you for my opportunity to testify on this bill, and thank Senator Schmidt for being open to hearing our testimony from Le Sueur County.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Pettis?
One.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I'm wondering what the effect of these mines in Kasota Township and Le Sueur County have had on the aquifer.
Mr. Pettis.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, there was substantial groundwater modeling done with the last EIS in Kasota. I'm really not able to answer that question, what the modeling showed, but there was a large part of the EIS that did deal with the groundwater, the reuse of water, and the impact to the aquifer. We have had a well committee for both of our expansions or all our projects consisting of the company, representatives of the county, and citizens to deal with well issues. And to this date, the well issues have been taken care of by the company in a manner that is satisfactory to the landowners.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pettis, in regard to Section 3, the rules, where it talks about the Pollution Control Agency, the DNR, and the Department of Health, do you have any connection with them right now in your county there with those three agencies dealing with reclamation of or sand mining?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Pettis.
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. As I stated before, the DNR is to review our reclamation plans. Mm-hmm. We just don't feel that rules, official rules, need to be written to deal with that. And Pollution Control and Department of Health have been involved within our permitting for these mines, yes. We're not opposing the Pollution Control or the Department of Health portion of the bill.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Pettis, there are already rules, guidelines for by the PCA and the Department of Health.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, before we take action on this bill, I just wanted to announce that Senator Dahl's bill 1224 is going to be carried over until tomorrow at 4 o'clock, and that Senator Schmidt's bill 796 we're also going to take up tomorrow at 4 o'clock to give our staff a little bit more time to work on the amendment. Any more questions?
Just, Madam Chair, I would like to move the bill.
On our testimony on the bill, we'd really like to vote on this bill tonight, so if you are in favor of the bill, you could just say you're in favor of the bill or make brief comments. You've been sitting here. They've been sitting here all day. So why don't you come forward?
Okay. I don't think they're in favor.
Oh, okay. Well, they've still been sitting here all day.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yeah, there are a couple of folks who have approached me here, and they'd like to say a few brief
all
words.
Right.
I will be brief as possible.
Well, we've shortened our agenda, so we're only going to take up Senator Sandrum's bill after this one.
Okay. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee senators. My name is Jim Dross. I live near Stillwater, Minnesota. I hold a BS and MS degrees in mining and metallurgical engineering. If you have in your documents, you should have a graph, a bar graph, which I'll be talking about. The attack by sand miners on Barron County, Wisconsin, began in earnest during the summer of 2011. And the aggression continues at an ever-increasing pace. The article above shows that for 3 years running, the number of foreclosures in Barron County was declining. But now, 6 to 9 months after many of these silica mines and processing plants have come online and trucking has begun, the first 6 weeks of 2013 has shown a jump in the foreclosures almost equaling the year 2009. This is just the beginning of Barron County's economic and environmental woes. Most of the people in the haul routes, processing plants, and mining areas have no land value remediation and cannot sell. They often just let the lender foreclose. Trucking, and that's not only in Barron County, that's across the state. Trucking, processing, and load should never be cited in cities like Red Wing, Wabasha, and Winona. In the little town of New Auburn, Wisconsin, a drying and loading facility showers the school children from ages from 4 to 18 every day with silica silt, with fine silica silt, extremely dangerous when the size is below 3 microns. The children are less than a quarter mile away from the plant and the loading. A certain number of them are almost assuredly to have silicosis in 10 to 20 years. The trucking with the accompanying fugitive silica sand dust pounding on the roads will destroy the businesses, the buildings that those businesses are housed in, jobs, tourist attractions, and many other environmental areas. Populations of these towns will begin to decline. The foreclosures will begin slowly at first, and the tax base will dwindle. Most importantly, all this will happen in behalf of an industry that cannot be sustained. Fracking for gas and oil cannot be sustained for a number of reasons, but the most important is the water is becoming in short supply across America. John Brewer had an article titled "Low Water, Big Problem" in the Sunday Pioneer Press. And Dave Orrick had an article titled "Minnesota's Water Shortage Forcing Many Towns to Take Drastic Measures." These articles deal with Minnesota's problems, but can be extrapolated around the country and the world for that matter. The Ogallala Aquifer, the largest aquifer in the United States, stretches across 8 states from Texas to South Dakota. In 1999, the Ogallala Aquifer still held 978 trillion gallons and had an average depth of to the water vein of 240 feet. Today, the Ogallala has been lowered to the depth of less than 80 feet. The estimate is that the aquifer has been between 5 to 10 years supply left before being exhausted. Fracking of oil and gas is using large amounts of water that renewal cannot begin to replace, destroying Minnesota wetlands and farmlands and sucking up fresh water to turn it into wastewater from frac sand processing makes no sense when it is supporting an industry that is doomed, and it will doom the people of this state and country for the sake of just a few years at best of gas and oil production. Sadly, the sand companies will make money and a few people will be employed for a few years, but all of it will be on the backs of the other people that will lose their jobs, their businesses will go bankrupt, people will become ill, etc. This can only be the height of the short-sightedness. Lastly, I recommend that one of the representatives of the Environmental Quality Board, Commissioner Investigating Team, have practical experience in the tactics of frac sand mining companies. I believe this will prove to be very valuable. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, bad news. We have to hear Senator Schmidt's bill 796 tonight because it has to go to judiciary tomorrow. So I'm just going to take a chair's prerogative. We've had several hours of testimony on this whole issue already, and I'd like to see if members have any other questions. We did amend it, didn't we?
Yes.
All right. Can we have a motion for this bill, please?
Madam Chair, I move that.
Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 1018, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, Senator Senjum, I'm going to give you a break, Senator Schmidt, because we're still working on the amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Senjum, thank you for being patient all evening.
Yep.
Me too. It can be.
She could have moved that social media one.
I might have another cold. It'd be my third today.
I should tell you.
I don't know.
Fill this up too. Say it.
But now I have to pay attention.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm in the minority, so that's the job.
That's what you do.
For us,
you
don't have to work like this.
Can you go get me another Coke? And my job, I'm an educator.
I think there's
not a bad dinner. Thank you.
I don't want to have a chair.
They didn't know something until midnight, 5 days earlier.
Okay, if the members of the audience would please be quiet. Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members. In the interest of a little bit of brevity, I'm just going to maybe defer my introductory comments, come back after a little more testimony, and turn the floor at this point over to the Mayor of Rochester, Minnesota, Ardell Brady.
And Senator Senjum, I know you've been through a number of committees, so, and I think people might be pretty familiar with this project. So we hope that we can just focus in on the creation of whatever the board
Madam
is.
Madam Chair, probably you're talking about the Development Authority.
Yes. Yes, thank you. And Mayor Brady, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Happy spring to you. It has been that all day today, even though many of us haven't seen that. I'm Ardell Brady. I'm the mayor of the city of Rochester, and I want to just quickly say that the city of Rochester has always worked closely with Mayo Clinic and the city, excuse me, and the community are enthusiastic in our support of DMC, Destination Medical Center. The city will be supporting the DMC financially. We've already got skin in the game. In November, as many of you know, Rochester voters approved by a 2-to-1 margin $20 million in city sales tax specifically to support DMC. The proposed growth caused by the level of private investment by the Mayo Clinic and others will require a level of public infrastructure that is beyond what the city of Rochester can handle alone and that the private sector will not fund. All business, job, and population growth requires public infrastructure to support the growth. Locally, the growth and economic impact offered by the DMC will benefit not just Rochester, but also our surrounding communities and the region as a whole. And just the other day, unsolicited, got a call from a council member in Plymouth that said that they support this because of the bioscience industry that's in their city and was hopeful that this would pass. We've got a strong coalition of community organizations and local government, business, and others who are committed to the DMC and to the successful passage of the finance plan, and I've cut out a lot just in brevity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I would now like to introduce Dr. Brad Narr, physician at Mayo Clinic.
Dr. Narr, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for having us. Once again, this is an economic development proposal. Mayo is a big employer in the state of Minnesota, the largest. You can see from your handouts there, about 43,000 employees in the state of Minnesota, about a $9.8 billion economic impact with approximately $1.5 billion in tax revenue to the state directly from the Mayo Clinic. We have a huge footprint in Rochester and employ people from 59 different counties in the state of Minnesota. So as a lifelong Minnesota resident and as a practitioner of medicine at Mayo for approximately 30 years, I'd like to enthusiastically endorse this. And without much further ado, I'd like you to hear about that authority.
And, Madam President, before I do that, we have a member of the construction trades here, Mr. Greg Andrus.
Yes.
Great. Could you just repeat your name, please?
Yep. Madam Chairman, committee, my name's Greg Andrus.
Andrus.
Yes.
Thank you.
I am here representing the men and women of the Southeast Minnesota Building and Construction Trades. We're here, of course, in favor of this project. This is a great opportunity for our members to be employed on these projects. We're currently doing work on these projects right now. We have full-time staff. These aren't temporary jobs. These are full-time jobs. Because of the size of the campus and the number of buildings on these campuses, we have full-time members working year-round maintaining these buildings. We see the opportunity to create an additional 1,500 to 2,000 additional jobs for our members. Along with that, our members, you know, with this economy and the construction industry, you know, we've seen some hard times. We're looking forward to, you know, the next 20 years to keep them employed. These are good-paying jobs. They make good money, along with the benefits that supports our communities.
Great, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Andrus?
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Right, another testifier?
Yep.
Okay.
We're attempting to go rapidly here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair,
I don't know
this
if it helps you or hurts you that we're all late and tired.
Late. Well, I don't know.
I don't know. We might be cranky. Who knows?
We're not going to do the psychology of this. Right. We're just going to. Wait, pardon?
Okay.
We're going to shift gears a little bit. Mr. Bob Dunn, who is with the Hamas Company, an organization that's worked with Mayo for a good number of months, at least, on the development of the Medical Destination Medical
Welcome,
Center.
Welcome, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, you've heard some basic comments about the structure of the DMC initiative. What we've tried to do over the last several years, actually, as we've been working with Mayo, is to come up with an economic development plan that is unique, and unique in a sense that we're trying to do something that gives the state of Minnesota a degree of control and security that's not often found with this type of economic development initiative. So to do that, what we've tried to do is reverse the normal economic development structure. What I mean by that is, in most cases in a project like this, the public dollars come in on the front end with the hope of realizing an economic or fiscal gain in terms of new taxes over time. Here what we've done is to reverse that to where the private investment, which over time will equal more than $5 billion, led almost entirely by Mayo's capital investment, those dollars will come in first, and only as new taxes are secured and certified by the state of Minnesota will dollars be allowed to come back through the authority to support funding $585 million of public infrastructure. So what we've tried to do, frankly, is take the risk away that normally is a part of this type of economic development structure by giving you certainty that new taxes are secured in an amount greater than what is needed to support the public infrastructure. So that's kind of a very simplistic way of describing a fairly complex bill. In order to do this, what we've done is to structure a public authority modeled around many similar governing bodies that you have here in the state of Minnesota. And the core concept there is to give the authority all of the control over the spending and all of the control over basically how the dollars will be spent, ultimately to total up to $585 million of public infrastructure. So that's kind of the basic context of how we've structured the bill. Our council will provide a little more in-depth analysis and summary of the specifics of how the authority will function.
Thank you. Just introduce yourself for the tape.
Certainly, Madam Chair. My name is Lynette Crandall, and I'm with Dorsey & Whitney. I serve as Public Finance and Economic Development Counsel to Mayo Clinic and to other public and private entities around the state. I'd just like to try to very briefly address the role of the authority, and then I'd be happy to take questions. The new Destination Medical Center Authority will be a special limited purpose political subdivision in the state. It's being established to direct state investment in public infrastructure. Direct the state investment in public infrastructure and the related activities, which will stimulate the private investment that you've heard about briefly here. As Mr. Dunn indicated, the DMC authority isn't unlike a housing and redevelopment authority, an economic development authority, or a port authority that you may have in your community. And I believe in your packet you've got a handout which has a chart that shows some of the similarities among these types of entities. With the assistance of a nonprofit economic development corporation and likely other municipal financial advisors, consultants, and legal counsel, the authority will establish a development plan that will set priorities for funding project costs to support the DMC mission and establish one or more development districts. Once it's been shown that the private investment has created an incremental increase in the designated state taxes over a baseline year that will be set, then and only then will the authority be authorized to issue bonds backed by a state appropriation. The authority will use those bond proceeds to fund project costs for public purposes. The projects will be selected by the authority, but it will be up to the state through the Department of Revenue, Minnesota Management and Budget, indeed, to establish the baseline for the taxes, to measure that tax growth, and ultimately to approve the issuance of the bonds and make the appropriations necessary to pay the debt service. So I know that was very brief, but I'd be happy to address any specific questions that you may have. And I believe Senator Senjum has some amendments as well to get the bill in shape.
I think the chart's very helpful.
Great.
Questions from members of the committee right now? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Crandall, you mentioned MMB. Have they come given their okay, or have they said that your proposition here is going to make it work? I mean, are they going to be able to make it work for what you're asking for?
Senator and Madam Chair, we have had very productive meetings to date with both the Department of Revenue and Minnesota Management and Budget. It's obviously a complex bill, and we're working on the measurement of the taxes. And MMB is, of course, analyzing how this fits into the state's capital investment guidelines, and we're continuing those discussions. But all signs that we've received have been positive that we'll be able to work through the issues, I think, and address any concerns that the agencies may raise.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Madam Chair, may I just offer, I mean, I think that is an absolute must before this basically goes forward. If we can't resolve these, why, we're going to have to come up with some alternatives. But I'm hopeful as well. We've had good discussions.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking on page 12, line 12. And I think you were here when we redid the eminent domain laws, Senator Senjum. I was here in the House, and I know it was a long, ugly process. And we took away the enabling of cities to use eminent domain for economic development. It was predicated on a case that had happened out east, and everyone was up in arms, and we took away that. And I was wondering, were you in favor of that bill when we passed it in 2000, and I think it was 7 or 8?
Yes. Senator Bach was the author of that. And, mm-hmm. and sure, absolutely. No, I think that, as I remember, that was a hallmark bill. I'm reasonably sure I voted for that.
I voted no.
Yeah.
And Ms. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
And that's why I'm wondering, when I look at line 12, we're giving power of eminent domain now to this authority, and I'm wondering how you feel about eminent domain now when we took away those. We took that away from everyone else in that bill.
Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Scalzi, I'm not sure what you're referring to. If you look at the list, you'll see all the port authorities, the economic development authorities, the housing and redevelopment authorities all have eminent domain capabilities, or at least authorizations. We certainly took it away from the standpoint of economic development, if that's what you're referring to. And I think we fully understand, with respect to this project, that you're not going to move through somebody else's property for economic development reasons. It has to be blight or one of the other features which allow you to move into that that program. But for strictly economic development, we understand that you can't. I would say this. It may be no secret I worked at Mayo. I full well know that there's a lot of space down there that Mayo itself has owned. They have planned on an expansion for many, many years, and so as property around the institution become available, they have typically, if they could, purchased that. And so I think before we run into that kind of a situation, having to use eminent domain, I think there's a lot of other options there that that are available well before we would perhaps need to get into that. But we fully understand eminent domain for economic development purposes is not permitted. Now, I'm not sure if I answered your question or not, but
okay. So we have the
happy to follow up if I didn't.
We have the A6 amendment, which Senate Counsel has said is kind of a cleanup amendment as you refine the language. Did you want to,
Madam Chair,
walk us through the amendment a little bit?
Madam Chair, yes. Except,
just the
Madam
main
Chair,
points,
on the A6 amendment,
minor.
I want to have the our counsel do that for me.
A6 amendment.
It's rather complicated, and she promised me she would.
I know you said, Miss Crandall, and you know you don't have to do minor things, just the important things.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I'll try to be very brief. Generally, we've added some defined terms. We've clarified some defined terms. We've made some technical corrections and cross-references to existing law and within the bill. One thing that you might be interested in is the definition of the project. We have worked to conform the definition of a project very closely to projects of other economic development entities in the state, so the ones that you see on that chart that you have before you. That is to be quite honest, I think the most significant change in the bill from the perspective of this committee's jurisdiction. We've made it clear that the open meeting laws of Chapter 13D apply to the authority board. We have made it clear who gets annual reports of the authority board. We've provided for an increase in the baseline of property taxes for the baseline of taxes for any property annexed by the city. And we've removed a cap on the annual appropriation to the authority for debt service on bonds, which would allow some more flexibility in structuring debt and accelerating payoffs. So I believe that those are the high points, but again, I'd be happy to address any specific questions.
I'm just checking to see if our counsel here had a chance to see the amendment ahead of time and look at it. Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the fourth page of your amendment, it talks about if after determination of the baseline designates state tax amounts, areas annexed to the city, is there areas here that are being looked at for development that are not in the city right now that would be annexed into it? I mean, I don't understand why that language is there for annexation purposes.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, Rochester is an expanding community, and obviously if we add 25 to 30,000 more jobs, it will ever more expand, and so annexation does occur, and it did when I was in the city council. It remains as an occurrence. And so what this does is it allows then for the tax base to be, if you will, captured with the new annexations as the city grows.
Captured for the project or just captured for the city?
The ability to, you know, we've got the baseline increment and we got the expanding increment as, okay, as Mayo grows. And as that expanding increment grows, it will include the annexed properties.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, if I could clarify, it actually, and Senator Senjum is correct, but we don't want to capture that artificial growth from annexation of other property in the calculation to determine what the authority would be able to bond for. And so we're essentially increasing the baseline to account for any growth that's not related to the DMC initiative.
Okay, any motion for the A6 amendment? Senator Dahl moves the A6 amendment. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion fails. It's a weak aye. It was like 2-0. I shouldn't say that on the tape.
Madam Chair, we also have the A7th amendment.
The A7 amendment.
Which deals with the development authority.
And then at some point we should look at the provisions in the bill. But if you'd like the A7 amendment discussed first.
Well, this will revise what is in the bill about the development authority.
Bill is evolving. Either of you seen this amendment? Oh, it does.
Yes.
It amends the A6 amendment.
Yep.
Is that?
We have to do it that way because we knew this was going to be adopted.
Okay.
And then this affects
Okay, members, just to make you aware that the A7 amendment modifies the A6 amendment. Senator Senjum, do you want to explain the amendment to us?
Madam Chair, yes, happy to. Procedurally, do you want to move it first or just would you like an explanation?
Typically, we have an explanation
if
it's not an author's amendment first.
Madam Chair, this is a revision, if you will, of the development authority as it is in the bill that that you had initially, and as it was initially drafted. And essentially what it does is it creates a development authority of 7 members appointed by the governor with staggering terms and confirmed by the Senate, each member confirmed by the Senate. The governor then would also pick one that is the chair of the development authority. And then lastly, on the sunset there, the development authority would sunset in 2043 with assets, if there are any left of the authority, going to the city of Rochester. And this is in part to create a little distance between the original between the authority and the operation of what's going on in Rochester relative to what we call a development corporation. In other words, the development corporation brings their plan to the authority and proves their case, and the thought is a little bit of distance with respect to people not living in Olmsted County or otherwise associated with Mayo in terms of potential conflict would be a better landscape, so to speak, in terms of objectivity.
I noticed that you don't put in any criteria for the type of people other than what they can't be. They can't be a resident of Rochester or have a direct or financial interest in Mayo. But other than that, what kind of people would you be looking for? Would you want to think about criteria or just a suggestion? I think we wouldn't have to do it tonight, but you might want to refine to provide the governor with some guidance.
Sure. And Madam Chair, we could certainly do that. We've been sort of working on this this authority and the makeup for actually a couple of weeks, trying to kind of find the right scenario, and we could certainly define that further in terms of skill sets,
mm-hmm.
or other things, even gender, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair,
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. I'm curious, Ms. Cranel, because I presume you've talked about this, but there is no language in this bill around liability and responsibility in terms of, kind of board's decisions and individuals that are members of the board. I don't see that in the language at all. In case, you're managing, they will be responsible for managing a tremendous amount of money. And I don't see the language here. I don't know if we will find it in another place. And then there is in page 8, subdivision 2, section 8, you have, subdivision 3, you have the duties and powers of the officers, and you describe that as being the usual duties and powers of the officers of their offices, meaning, you know, I guess the offices that they represent in their usual daily jobs, and then may be given other duties and powers by the authority. As I presume, I don't know if it is redundant or staff may speak to the, bill, right? The need to add a sentence in there, because I think that these powers and duties are related to the responsibilities prescribed in this legislation.
Right.
So I don't think that is clear in there. I think there is a missing sentence. So if you could speak to those two issues.
Ms. Crandall.
Certainly, Madam Chair and and Senator. I can confirm that we have discussed the issue of liability in the Judiciary Committee, the prior stop. And we actually determined that there are some special liability provisions for these other types of entities, your local EDA or HRA or Port Authority. We decided that it was best that just the general municipal liability laws that are in statute would apply to this body. There are some questions about why some of these other entities have some special treatment. So the liability laws that would apply to your city, your county, would apply to this authority as well. With respect to duties and powers, again, I believe this is a little bit of a boilerplate section here, and I believe the intention, again, is just that while the treasurer's duties are often spelled out for these types of entities, we don't see a lot of description of you know, chair, vice chair types of duties, but certainly if there's something specific to the DMC initiative that we could look at or think about, we'd be happy to talk with you about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not necessarily prepared to suggest, but I think it's in your best interest that you provide some clarity here and that you specifically address that. Because this is the document that will guide you afterwards. Sure. So no. I think it's important that you include that in here.
Madam Chair, just so I understand, Senator Torres-Ray, you would be looking for a little more clarity on the duties of the authority members in terms of their specific roles. Is that somewhat right?
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sanjum, I believe that it's in your best interest to have that stipulated here so that it's clear. You know, this entire bill talks about, you know, kind of the duties and powers in a sense. But I think it's important that you stipulate that in here as they apply in these different sections, and also the issue of liability. I think that it is important that you stipulate that clearly in here so that you, if the legislation that applies to municipalities is the same, I think you need to state that in here just so that it's clear. But that's kind of my recommendation.
Madam Chair and Senator, we'd be happy to include that express provision, and we can prepare an amendment, work with council to prepare an amendment for that.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and maybe you could answer this question for me. It seems to me that it's unusual to have a board that would be overseeing a project that is not involved with the city itself. Is that common?
I think maybe Senator Senjum could respond to why he did that. Because it was originally they did have city members on the board.
And I was just wondering if it's common in other boards, if you know that,
No, I think the way he originally structured it is probably far more common.
Yeah.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, there is within the framework of the bill something called an economic development corporation, and they will really create the plan, if you will, the master plan for the redevelopment transformation of downtown Rochester and the surrounding, you know, Mayo complex. And so the thought was that they will produce the ideas, they will basically put together the projects, and then they would be required to prove their salt, so to speak, in terms of selling an outside, perhaps I think we think, maybe a more objective group of people that aren't necessarily within the framework of the community. In other words, you have a great idea, but you still have to prove it, perhaps not unlike the legislature.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Crandall.
And Senator, if I could add, the development plan that we talked about will be created in conjunction with the city, and the city will actually make a determination that it is consistent with the city's existing comprehensive plan. And all of the city land use zoning laws will be applicable. And so this will be a process where the authority board will need to work very closely with the city.
Madam Chair, so
Senator
there is
Johnson.
Nothing in this bill about this authority that you're speaking of right now.
It's on page 5, subdivision 10.
Where is it?
Page 5, subdivision 10, the Medical Center Economic Development Corporation.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Crandall.
I guide you to the last page of your colored handout here, which I think you have, and that shows the roles, essentially, of the various entities. The Economic Development Corporation is on the far right, and you'll see that that is really just an advisory role. That will be an entity that can actually, it will be formed. The intention is as a 501c3 nonprofit entity. So it could raise private contributions for investment in the DMC initiatives. It will act much as a municipal financial advisor would do on a local property tax increment project. It will facilitate the authority board in developing the plan that will guide the direction of the projects and the expenditure of the funds. But ultimately, the authority will have control over the adoption of the plan, which projects will be selected for funding. And, of course, at the state level, again, we've talked about the involvement of DOR, MMB, DEED, and, of course, the legislature in continuing the ability of the authority to actually issue debt over a number of years. It's actually anticipated that this will be a 20-year plan with debt issued over that time as needs arise, as private development opportunities become available.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I go back to a question of Senator Scalzi?
Senator Sanchin.
And maybe to have our counsel relate to me as she did relate to Senator Scalzi as she did to me some weeks ago about the Development Authority and the need for the condemnation insert here. And it revolves around that if you're going to have bond authorization authority, that you need to have certain you need to do some functions of government, and I'll stop there and let her explain.
Ms. Crandall.
Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, yes, you'll note from the chart that, again, similar entities in Minnesota do have the power of eminent domain. The existing constraints on the exercise of that authority would apply to the DMC authority as well. So the provisions of Chapter 117, and Senator Sanchin was correct, economic development alone is not a purpose for which property can be taken in Minnesota or many other states in the nation these days. So the authority would have to follow that criteria. As a bond lawyer, it was also very important for me to see this provision in the bill to be able to issue tax-exempt debt of the authority, so at the lowest possible cost of borrowing to the state. Under the federal tax code, the issuer needs to have one of three sovereign powers, and those powers are taxation, police power, or eminent domain. This authority doesn't have any police power. Of course, that resides with the city. It doesn't have the ability to tax, unlike other economic development entities in the state, and so it must have the eminent domain power to be able to issue tax-exempt debt.
Madam Chair, this is
Senator
very
Johnson.
Helpful now that I've been directed to this.
Yeah. So, members, we have the A7 amendment. Bora, someone want to offer the A7 amendment?
So moved.
Senator Dahl moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Between the two charts and the discussion, do members have enough sense of what the government structure is? Do we want Ms. Crandall or Senator Sanchin to walk us through different sections? What is the desire of people, or do you feel ready to vote or ask more questions? Senator Scalzi.
Ms. Chair, and I'm wondering, what is the purview of this? I mean, I don't know that we have to see all the sections. There's a lot of financial information in here as well. But I think that the areas that apply to state and local government.
All right, Ms. James, why don't you, and Ms. Stengel, why don't you just point out, you know, what our jurisdiction is, and we'll just take a look at those sections.
Madam Chair and members, I would point out that the establishment of a new authority is something within the jurisdiction of this committee. So that is on, it's all over the A7 amendment.
The A7 amendment.
And then that is also bill. Page 7. Section 6,
which was replaced by the amendment. So then on page 7.
Yes, on the A7 amends page 7.
And then anything else on the bill? Or is that it?
That's it from the state government.
State government. And Ms. Stengel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 7 partially touches on the characteristics that it's a political body, political subdivision. There's not a lot of meat in that section.
That's on page 8.
Yes, sorry. Part of Section 8 apply. We added that new subdivision 10 that says Chapter 13D applies for the open meeting law. That would be within our purview as well. There are a few provisions in Section 10 that talk about reporting and things like that that are done by local governments.
On page 10, Subdivision 4. Nope, not really.
Subdivision 5, perhaps, with the budget law.
With 5. What does that mean, subdivision 5 on 10.12? What is the budget law?
Madam Chair, I think that's a wonderful question. I can't tell you exactly.
Ms. Crandall,
what
do you
means.
Know?
Certainly. And actually, Madam Chair, I will confess that in the sections that you're citing, there's not a lot of original language there. Again, the goal was to make this entity have very similar powers and duties and functions of any other type of economic development entity in the state. With respect specifically to the provision regarding outside budget laws, this is, again, something that a port authority and an economic development authority, I believe, both have an exception from. And how I would interpret this is that the normal process for adopting and amending a budget of the city would not need to be followed, and debt limits or other budgetary restrictions would not apply.
On page 11, subdivision 2, there is a requirement that the development plan has to be approved by the city. So we're looking at a local government approval.
On page 14, starting on line 19, we have reference to projects being subject to a variety of local ordinances. Throughout here, there are references to the authority being able to do things like cities like contract for service, buy supplies, work with the city for purchasing, use city facilities. And then the rest looks to be...
On page 1610, reporting requirements, we did change. There's a report to the legislature, and that language was changed in an amendment to report to the chairs of the appropriate committees like we usually do, and minority leads. And what about approval of the commissioner? No.
The remainder is mostly about the bonding and the taxing.
Bonding
and
funding.
Taxing.
That's probably it. So I think the primary job we have is the authority, the establishment of the authority in the A7 amendment. So if there's any questions about any more for Senator Senjum about the appointees by the governor confirmed by the Senate. It's kind of the plan. Any other questions? Anybody else want to testify? This bill goes to taxes. Any motions?
Madam Chair, before you make a motion, I just wanted to make a comment because I think this is so exciting. Senator Senjum, in this bill, in page 11, it says that one of the responsibilities is for the development of the city, and then the plan includes strategic planning consistent with a global destination medical center in the core areas of commercial research and technology, learning, environment, hospitality, and convention, sports and recreation, livable communities, etc. And I think this is such a remarkable thing that, Minnesota has this amazing opportunity to really capture all of that and figure out what that is and become this. Mayo is already a global destination, but this project takes it to a scale that will be an incredible opportunity for this state and for this region. And I feel that we need to learn more as legislators about what this is and how it works and how these strategies are documented so that we can replicate this in our state. So I just think this is an amazing opportunity. When we talk about global destinations, we typically don't talk about Minnesota as being a global destination outside of the Mayo Clinic. And I don't know if the Mall of America thinks in those terms as well, but certainly, the clinic is. And I just think that this is this captures an amazing opportunity for the future, and we need to make sure that we have ample documentation of how that works and how we can learn from it and how we can promote it and just use it as a model that is a model of the future. So I just wanted to make a comment on that because I think that's pretty remarkable that we have that opportunity.
Senator Horace-Ray, do you want to make a motion?
Yes. I move that Senate File 343.
Wait a minute. Before you make that motion, Senator Scalzi.
And I would just like to say, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and my concern with a lot of what's in here, and I'd like to see it move ahead to go to taxes, my concern with a lot of what's in here is that this is a precedent we're setting here. And in my district, I've got a 427-acre piece of property, that the TCAP property, that has poor roads, almost became a Viking stadium. And I would like to be able, if we do this for one, I would like to be able to have this available and have a developer capable of using this type of a setup for that, because it's going to need it today to get a good development. And I just think that we're opening up the doors, and I understand where you're coming from, but you should understand where I'm coming from, because once the door is open, it should be available to all.
Senator Scalzi, just speaking as one senator, I think that's the kind of thing that we'd all invite. These are proposals that, frankly, in this particular one, I know it probably can't happen in Minnesota unless we advance this kind of an idea. And there may be many other proposals, your property included, that need this kind of an idea to move forward. And as we talk about literally the billions of dollars worth of investment, up to five, perhaps six, 25 to 30,000 jobs, that's significant. And your project is very well, perhaps potentially significant too. But I think Minnesota needs to, again, think out of the box a little bit. Insofar as I'm aware, this is probably the first project of its kind like this in this country. And so we are moving the ball. We are probably setting a precedent. But I think it's the kind of precedent that can produce good things for our state and, frankly, even our country. So it's not all bad. I think we just need to open our eyes a little bit more sometimes and see that vision as it might be.
Senator Torres-Ray moves that, I lost the bill, Senate File 343 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Okay, thank you very much, Senator Senjum.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Remember, members, we still have to do the Schmidt bill, but Senator Schmidt is going to be very brief, and just we I think we have an amendment for it. So Senator Schmidt, we're just interested in whatever you're doing around rulemaking and whatever kind of committee, commission, task force that you set up in this bill. And we understand it's a DNR bill, and none of that is in our jurisdiction. Just want to make sure you get the committee set up properly by our guidelines.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, good to be back here again today. I see that we have the A9 amendment, so that's being passed around.
Coming, yeah.
Since this is the first time I've seen it, so maybe we could allow counsel to speak to it when we have an opportunity. And I appreciate the fact that we're hearing this bill tonight. Thank you.
And Senator Schmidt, on page 16, is this the only section 31? Is that rulemaking? Is that the only section of rulemaking?
You know, I could speak to this, and we're also going to have some folks from DNR here. A lot of the rulemaking language, in fact, all the rulemaking language, is coming from the DNR's request here. I think we have sections prior to the amendment here. I don't think we have any section renumbering here. Prior to the amendment, my view is that sections 1, 2, 28, 54, 55, 56, and 57 all apply to rulemaking. And those would be the ones that we may have an interest in discussing here. And at that time, maybe we could have – is DNR in the room here?
Madam Chair.
Oh.
Senator Johnson.
Could you list those sections again? I wasn't ready to write them down. 1, 8, 1, 2.
I didn't write it down either.
Pages, please.
Okay.
We'll just let the Mr. DNR. All right. Introduce yourself, please, for the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Hirsch. I'm DNR Director of Ecological and Water Resources. Unfortunately,
that's Hirscher.
Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H. Okay. Unfortunately, I'm not the lead on this bill. The person who was left when it was announced it wasn't going to be heard tonight. So I'll try to help as much as
when
I can.
When we first said we weren't going to hear it tonight,
yes.
Right?
And tried,
and then we found out about
I thought
the
I had a
thing.
Cell phone number on me, and I don't. Okay. So I tried to get a hold of him but wasn't able to. I'll try as my best to
So what we're looking basically here is wherever we see the Commissioner of Natural Resources may adopt rules. Is that... Is that the idea?
That's right. Madam Chair, in Section 1 here, we have line 2.8. Essentially, what we're doing is we're extending the rulemaking authority to include the need to adjust season variables on an annual basis based upon current biological and harvest data. So I don't know if you want to try to run through it like this or if there's anything more we can offer. I'm sorry. This is the first I heard that DNR would, you know. Why is it going to be here? Yeah, there we go. So, we have
never go home until.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Nothing like deadlines. So that's Section 1, and in Section 2 we have a federal law compliance. If folks have any questions about that, we can get into it. It's simply federal law compliance. Section 28. Moving on here.
Section 28?
28, yeah, because not all sections apply to rulemaking, which if they don't apply to rulemaking, I don't think we have an interest in.
All right,
and again, this
give
is
us the page number then.
Oh,
we
sure.
Go a little slower so we can all
right.
Follow.
And just, again, to reiterate for folks, this is the omnibus game and wildlife, or I'm sorry, Fish and Wildlife Bill. A lot of information here from DNR and also some language from individual bills that came before us. But the rulemaking language is all from DNR. So again, in 28, this is regarding take a kid fishing weekends, and it gives the commissioner rulemaking authority regarding whether I think let's see, on lines 15.29, the commissioner may by written order published in the state register establish a 3-day consecutive periods in which this is applicable. And it simply says that the written order is not subject to rulemaking provisions in Chapter 14.
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong bill? Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. No wonder I can't follow you.
Okay, so this is Senate File 796, the first engrossment. All right, so we've gone through Sections 1, 2, and 28. And now we're on
Does
section.
Does everyone have the first engrossment, or are you as confused as me? Great. Only me was confused. Page 28. There's the take a kid fishing weekends. Okay. After 28.
After 28. Now we're moving on to section 54, which is on page 28. And again, in line 28.7, it says the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall amend Minnesota rules. This is regarding game fish eggs as bait. And the next couple of sections here, sections 55, 56, and 57, all deal with similar rulemaking authority. First for spearing rough fish in section 55 on 28.33. Secondly, for restitution value for sandhill cranes in section 56, and also rulemaking specific to removing spearing restrictions in 29.16. That's section 57. And again, it all regards granting rulemaking authority.
And these are all at the request of DNR?
All at the request of DNR, yes.
Okay, so I see language on the report to the legislature. Okay, and then did you say they added a task force or something?
Yes.
Okay, so now we need an amendment?
Yeah, there is the A9 amendment before us now.
All right. And has that been passed on?
I believe everyone has it. Perhaps if council could walk us through it.
I don't have the A9 amendment.
Yes, I have an extra. I got one. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, this may not be the cleanest piece of work we've seen tonight, but on page 9, section 15, there's established a commission, and we'll come back to some specifics about it, but just also notice that on page 10, beginning on line 10.18, there's established a legislative advisory committee, and beginning on line 10.32, there's the establishment of a technical advisory task force. The legislative advisory committee and the technical advisory task force both serve the commission that begins on page 9. So the Legislative Advisory Committee and the task force are both set up in a relatively informal format, and that may serve its purposes. The commission probably could use some additional detail. So turning to the amendment, line 1.2 of the amendment, on page 10, going to the bill, it inserts on page 10, line 17, upon at least 5 days' notice. So this provides that the commissioner shall meet at the call of the chair and at the call of three of its members upon at least 5 days' notice instead of merely 5 days' notice. And then in place of on line 10.17, in place of but, insert and at least twice in each calendar year. And then after that line, we would insert a sentence that would say that we'll set a deadline for the governor to appoint the first members. So the governor shall appoint the first members within 3 months of final enactment.
Does that sound okay?
That sounds fine, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Page 10, line 21. And this I took license on, and this may not be what Senator Schmidt would like. But as it reads in the first engrossment, beginning on line 10.21, five of the legislative members are appointed by the Speaker of the House, and five of the legislative members are appointed by the Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee on Rules and Administration. So the result of that would probably be that you would have all majority members. And if that's what you'd like, then we shouldn't change that. But if you would like representation by both majority and minority, the amendment does that on line 1.7 through line 1.10 of the amendment.
We typically do that.
Yeah, I'm amenable to that, so thank you.
Okay. And then...
Do you have a question about that, Senator Anderson?
The line before that says delete 5 and insert 3.
Yes, because you're going to... Right, to engross it, right now it says actually starting on line 10.21, it says it would be comprised of 5 members of the House appointed by the Speaker. So we're going to change that to 3 members of the House appointed by the Speaker. And then moving on to the next line of the amendment, line 1.7 of the amendment, inserts on line 10.22 of the bill, 2 members of the House of Representatives appointed by the minority leader. So you still have 5 members of the House. 3 of them will now be appointed by the Speaker and 2 of them by the minority leader. And then we do the same thing with the Senate members.
Okay.
Okay. And then on line 10.25, the first engrossment called for the members of the advisory committee to be selected by January 31st of the odd-numbered years. That would mean that this group wouldn't get started until 2015, and you might want them started earlier. So I changed it to the even-numbered years.
Sure. That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. I mean, if you're getting my drift here, I think it's important that we start this commission. These details, I think, are very helpful, but just getting this started is important.
And members, line, and then on the amendment, line 1.12, it has an insertion for the bill at page 10, line 31 at the end of that sentence. This provides for the Legislative Advisory Committee to elect a chair from among its Senate members, its first chair from among its Senate members. It's going to, the chair rotates between the House and the Senate every 2 years, so we're just taking the prerogative for the first chair to come from the Senate. And then the Senate, back to line 1.13 of the amendment, the Senate Subcommittee on the Committee of the Committee on Rules and Administration will designate one of its first appointees to convene the first meeting of the Legislative Advisory Committee by, and I have a blank for the date, and they're going to designate a person who acts as chair until the committee elects a chair at its first meeting. And then the amendment goes on to say that the Legislative Advisory Committee shall sunset when the commission sunsets.
Sure.
So you should think about filling in that blank.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And then moving on to page 11, line 28, the first engrossment calls for a report to the governor and the legislature of each state. And by each state, I believe we're talking about Minnesota and Wisconsin. In Minnesota, we report not to the legislature generally, but to the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees of our Senate and House with primary jurisdiction over a topic. I inserted natural resources. You maybe want that to be environment and natural resources.
Okay.
And then I don't quite know how the Wisconsin legislature would want to be reported to. I have not fixed how we would report to the legislature of Wisconsin. Maybe we just want to say, and to the Wisconsin legislature.
And Senator Schmidt, that could be like a placeholder, you know, and you could fix that in the tax committee. But just so you
that's
know,
fine.
That's
no, idea. I appreciate that. And, of course, none of this is effective necessarily until this commission is created by both states. So, and, of course, this goes onto taxes and then conference committee. So we'll have an opportunity to craft this.
So just to be clear, on line 1.21 of the amendment, it would read, representatives with primary jurisdiction over environment and natural resources and to the Wisconsin legislature. Then, on page 11, we would delete line 36 and insert, this is because beginning on line 11.35, it calls for the first meeting to be called by the members of the first state to enact the commission. And that's just vague and difficult to know who exactly would call the call the first meeting. So I've inserted instead on line 36, the governor of Minnesota, within 3 months of final enactment of legislation establishing a boundary area invasive species commission by Wisconsin or by Minnesota, whichever is later. It should be. Yeah. So we've taken the reins that the governor of Minnesota will convene the first meeting. Okay. And then after line 36, inserting a sunset date. This is on line 1.26 of the amendment. The commission shall sunset January 16th, 2021. I picked a date, but there's another date that works better. You can certainly change it. And that's the amendment.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I think this is very helpful, and this is one of the many reasons we stopped by state and local government here with this bill. So thank you. I would accept this is a friendly amendment. I think this improves the bill and adds clarity to this particular section.
Do you want to leave it blank on 115?
If we could, I would prefer to do that right now, yeah.
And I think Ms. James also said that she thought that some of your language on the Legislative Advisory Committee and the Technical Advisory Task Force was a little vague or broad, and so you might want to consult with her further in, you know, your next couple stops to see if you want to sharpen it up.
Well, thank you, Madam.
But we don't need to take any more time tonight, I don't think.
Thank you, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Schmidt. My understanding, and I was on the Natural Resource Committee last year as vice chair, we've had lots of discussion. We continue to have lots of discussion with Wisconsin. What's the purpose of putting something like this together when we seem to already have good cooperation with them and having discussion over this?
Sure. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. This elevates the issue of invasive species, of aquatic invasive species in particular. It's a challenge in southeastern Minnesota with the Mississippi River, serving as a border between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And I think this elevates that issue and calls attention to the need for conversation between Minnesota and Wisconsin on this. So that's why we've put it in the bill. This is a bill that I believe Senator Saxog has carried in the past and urged me to include it in our bill as well this year. So it makes a lot of sense to me, and it doesn't add any cost. I think this is something that is going to add some value if we're able to get our neighbors to the east to propose this. And to my knowledge, they have in the past. I think at a couple of points in the last 10 years, they have proposed a similar approach, and Minnesota was not interested in that time of doing this. And I think it's worthy of extending the offer again at this time.
Senator Schmidt, just so you're aware that whenever we place legislators on any kind of board or commission, you have to go to the Rules Committee. They'll pick it up in the Rules Committee. Yeah. They are.
Yeah. We don't. They're not.
They're not compensated.
They're
okay.
Not legislators.
Oh,
yes, they are.
There's legislators.
There, yeah.
Right. Okay. Senator Eaton moves the A9 amendment. Is there any discussion?
As orally amended.
Is everyone clear on the oral amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any more discussion on the bill? Anyone in the audience want to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, is there a motion? Senator Eaton moves that Senate Bill 796 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
Motion.
No. Motion prevails. Members, thank you very much. We have our next meeting is tomorrow at 4 o'clock. We have a couple bills carried over, and I don't know how many additional ones we have. But we have some. Oh, at 4 o'clock tomorrow, that's all?